Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did the turbulent 1960s and 70s shape the evolution of San Francisco into the city we know today? The city by the bay has been a magnet for offbeat characters since it mushroomed overnight during the California Gold Rush. But by the time the Haight-Ashbury neighborhood had become the official epicenter of the hippie movement, San Francisco politics had long been the domain of socially conservative Italian and Irish Catholics, who were more than dismayed by the rapid arrival and rising influence of a younger and more diverse population of newcomers, who brought with them not only new attitudes, but new problems with drugs and violent crime. Salon founder David Talbot tells the story of the city's struggle for a unified identity in his new book, Season of the Witch, Enchantment, Terror, and Deliverance in the City of Love. David, welcome to Think.
Great to be here, Chris.
It's so interesting because in many ways this is a local history, and yet San Francisco is a lot like New Orleans in that as Americans, we see this as a sort of national treasure that belongs to all of us, even those of us who've only been there for a visit.
That's true. And, of course, Hollywood loves it as a movie set. A lot of films and TV shows shot here, an iconic city. And a city that I think drew people from all around the country, the, sort of the dreamers and outcasts. So it really is an American city in that sense.
Talk a little bit about how the city's political infrastructure took shape in the early part of the 20th century.
Well, in the early, the very early days, of course, back to the Gold Rush days of the 1840s, San Francisco was a wild frontier town where anything went. The saying here was, "You can do anything you want, just don't scare the horses." and that spirit prevailed into the 20th century. Even during the Prohibition era, the 1920s, the local Board of Supervisors passed a law that prevented the police department from enforcing the dry laws against alcohol. So San Francisco, long before Las Vegas was promising to keep everyone's secrets, was that kind of town. But around the 1920s, a new culture begins to develop here, sort of a very working-class, traditional Catholic social structure, heavily Irish and Italian, and that network really begins to take over the city, government and politics.
And so for a while, there continued to be those outcasts, but their overall power was sort of kept in check by the political system and certainly by the police department.
That's right. So that wild San Francisco starts to go underground in that period. And you did have sort of early gay clubs and bohemian sort of enclaves within the city, even back in the early part of the century. But they're very underground and they're subject to police sweeps and a lot of arrests and a lot of harassment.
A lot of young men saw San Francisco for the first time when they were shipping out to the Pacific Theater in World War II.
Exactly. And that's why I think how San Francisco really takes off in the national consciousness. Here you have farm boys and people from all over the country shipping through this, fascinating city. Those of you listening who've been to San Francisco know how physically beautiful it is. It's this white, gleaming city that's set on hills overlooking the bay. It's a very Mediterranean-looking city. And so these young men being shipped off to the Pacific Theater during World War II literally had their minds blown in many ways by the city, both its beauty and also by the social license, what was possible here, the kind of the night scene and some of these underground clubs and so on.
Talk a little bit about the development of the arts and music scene in the 1960s and the influence of impresarios, people like Bill Graham and others.
Yeah, well, of course, that really begins in a way in the 1950s with the Beat movement. Mm-hmm. The Beats, were early pioneers here. Lawrence Ferlinghetti, Getty, the great poet who, buys City Lights bookstore and turns that into an oasis, a haven for these young hipsters who are showing up from all over the country, including Allen Ginsberg, the great poet who writes Howl, sort of the masterpiece of the Beat movement right here in San Francisco. And I think that was partly the reason why hippies then, the young people in the 60s, were attracted to the city, because it already had this aura of freedom and creative achievement. And so young people began showing up here in the 60s, in the mid-60s, and particularly, of course, in 1967, the Summer of Love. They're drawn by the music, the Jefferson Airplane, the Grateful Dead, and this kind of even pre-internet sort of signal that goes out throughout the country. Like, if you're young, if you're, on the road, San Francisco is the place to end up. And, of course, the city is overwhelmed by this invasion. Here, a city that's still very conservative in many ways, a conservative Catholic town, is suddenly having to deal with this army of young people who've shown up on the streets from all over the country.
And when you say on the streets, you mean on the streets. There are vagrants, there are runaways. Suddenly there are lots of people who have no permanent home but plan to stay.
Absolutely, and sleeping in the parks. And here they thought, California, summer, it's going to be beautiful, sunshine. Those of you who've been here in the summer, tourists, know that San Francisco in the summer can be very cold and damp. And, you know, we have this juggernaut of fog that rolls in the late afternoon. And if you have light clothing on, like these kids did, and were sleeping in the parks and the street, it could be very daunting. And, of course, a lot of them get sick, and there's nowhere for them to turn. They have drug issues. They have, you know, everything from hepatitis to malnutrition. And the city turns a cold shoulder to them. Even the big hospital in the Haight-Ashbury district, St. Mary's, refuses to deal with them and their drug issues. So a young, brave doctor named Dr. Smith opens up the Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic, and that, to me, is in some ways the beginning of this whole notion of a free city, a liberated city, a city that takes care of its own.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, because where one might have imagined that all of this fell as the responsibility of sort of the taxpayer, instead it was these sort of ground-up groups that began to provide these services.
That's absolutely right. It's the grassroots that, because they see the city itself, official San Francisco, is refusing to deal with it. So groups like the Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic, there was another great street group called the Diggers,
yeah,
that believed that everything should be free, free clothes, free music in the park, free food. And they almost approached it like a theater group, which essentially they were. They were young, kind of radical underground actors who came out of the San Francisco Mime Troupe. Peter Coyote, one of the more well-known members. Of course, you hear his voice all the time now in commercials, and he's an actor. And they really turned all San Francisco into their own stage and you know, were promoting this idea that the community needed to take care of itself, not buy things from companies, not go hat in hand to the government, but everyone should be taking care of each other for free.
Talk about how the Diggers free stores would work.
Well, it was a great store that had a lot of recycled clothes on Haight Street, and people would go in, some of the people, no money, you know, you'd have the shoplifters, and someone would start to steal something, and the guy running the store, the digger, would go, hey, you can't do that. Everything's free. So, you know, it was a very open feeling to everything in those days. And, you know, look, they drew, among the great people that San Francisco drew, of course, were Texas's own great Janis Joplin from mm-hmm. Port Arthur, and Chet Helms, the great rock impresario, who in some ways is the yin to Bill Graham's yang. Bill, of course, was a very tough, you know, New York kind of hustler. Chet was more laid back, you know, sort of easygoing guy. And he put together the great band Big Brother and the Holding Company with Janis. And he sort of pieced them together one member at a time. And so, you know, a lot of, you know, these great young people from Texas and all over the country were having a huge impact on San Francisco.
Let's talk about Haight-Ashbury, because I think it has a reputation today that may not reflect the entire reality there. It was a place filled with hippies. It could also be really rough, and the drug problem was not insignificant.
Exactly. A lot of people think, you know, well, the Haight sort of declined in later years in the 70s. But, you know, the seeds of the Haight sort of downfall were there from the very beginning. Hard drugs come in pretty early. The Diggers started experimenting themselves with heroin and you know, succumbed to heroin addiction themselves, the leaders of the Diggers, Emmett Grogan and Peter Coyote. You know, also San Francisco was not an island. I mean, San Francisco, of course, absorbed everything that was happening in the rest of the country, and a lot of young soldiers were coming back from Vietnam with their own drug problems, having gotten addicted in Vietnam because there was a lot of heroin there as well and other drugs, and they wash up on the shores of the Haight, too. And they came to the Haight because they felt it was an oasis, that they could be find the other young people like themselves after all the horrors they've been through in war, that the Haight represented the exact opposite, peace and love and so on to them. But, you know, there were a lot of problems on the streets, and hard drugs start moving in, drugs that actually had never been seen before outside of government laboratories suddenly are appearing on the streets of the Haight. STP, which was a real mind-blowing hallucinogen that you know, became briefly popular and really wrecked a lot of people. And so, you know, there were some who actually believed that the authorities were flooding the Haight with experimental drugs. And I quote one person saying that they felt the government had turned the Haight into a human guinea pig lab. So you know, there was a lot of there was crime, there was a lot of violence on the streets, and a lot of people think the hate is going to be, you know, go the way of the Fillmore District, which is the great black neighborhood in San Francisco, which had been bulldozed by the redevelopment agency here.
And in fact, that was a consideration. Some people said, well, why don't we just raise the place and therefore we eliminate the problem, almost like tearing down a building and letting all the rats run away.
Exactly. And a lot of people felt, you know, that the police department had turned its eye away from the hate, that they were basically saying, well, let them all just, you know, destroy each other. And this is what happened, as I said, in the great, very once vibrant black community in San Francisco. It once had been called the Harlem of the West. Great music, you know, great nightclubs, Duke Ellington, Billie Holiday, Louis Armstrong, all the great musicians of the day playing in the Fillmore. But unfortunately, right, the redevelopment agency moved in and leveled it. And the hate was the next on their agenda. But something interesting happens. While Mayor Alioto, who's a very interesting figure at that point, liberal guy in many ways, but also very tough and very tough on the hippies.
Elected in 1968, is that right?
That's right. Mm-hmm. He starts to move in, you know, launching a lot of police raids on the neighborhood. But a tough group of hippies takes a stand. And most people think, of course, as hippies with, you know, people, you know, kind of frail characters with flowers in their hair. But these were a group of ex-cons, ex-Vietnam veterans, tough street runaways, who form an organization, a commune called the Good Earth Family. And they take over abandoned houses. They're, you know, and the hate is full of beautiful Victorians that had been let, you know, were deteriorating as people abandoned the neighborhood. But the Good Earth people move in, they fix them up, they open businesses, they open a garage, a car, you know, mechanics garage, a paint crew, a clothing store, and they start dealing marijuana. And they're making a lot of money, and they're very successful. At one point, hundreds of people belong to this commune. But the point is, they stood their ground. They drove the heroin dealers out at gunpoint, because these were guys from Vietnam who knew how to use guns. They drove the hard drug dealers out of the neighborhood. They fought with the cops when they thought the cops were out of line, and they protected the hate. And many people credit the hate's existence today as still a very vibrant community that draws people, young people from all over the country, credit that group with, at a very key point in San Francisco's history, protecting the hate.
David, what role did the Hells Angels play?
The Angels are fascinating because, again, sort of that devil and angel combination, literally. You know, in the early days, again, when the streets were really tough in the hate, and, you know, there were rogue cops harassing people and, you know, these tough drug dealers, hippies looked to the Hells Angels for protection, and there was a lot of affection in the hate for the Hells Angels. People liked their tough style, they liked the leather, they liked the bikes, Janis Joplin among them, you know, really fell for these guys. And the Grateful Dead and other bands often used them for security at their free concerts in Golden Gate Park and elsewhere. But as I say in the book, the Hells Angels were like a jungle cat that you bring into a party on a leash. It could be cool, or it couldn't be. And, of course, it wasn't cool when the Hells Angels were used by the Rolling Stones at the famous Altamont Rock Concert in 1969.
Let me stop you there. We'll take a quick break and get that story in just a moment. My guest is the founder of Salon, David Talbot. He's got a new book out called Season of the Witch, Enchantment, Terror, and Deliverance in the City of Love. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is David Talbot. He is the founder of Salon and author of the new book Season of the Witch, Enchantment, Terror, and Deliverance in the City of Love. Join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. David, you were just about to tell us the story of Altamont and what happened there when the Rolling Stones were giving this free concert and had contracted with the Hells Angels to provide security, and things turned very, very ugly.
Yeah, and of course, Altamont then goes down in history as, in many people's minds, the end of the 60s. I dispute that, of course. I mean, the 60s continue to provoke and agitate the public consciousness in America to this very day. But in any case, yes, the Altamont concert is held in a sort of scrubby outlying suburb of San Francisco, Speedway, and of course the Grateful Dead, New Speedway Boogie, later, you know, commemorate that awful day. And the Hells Angels were brought in by the Rolling Stones at the suggestion of the Grateful Dead, who had used them quite amicably in the past at concerts. But things start turning very rough. The Hells Angels are taking drugs and, you know, speed and cheap red wine, drinking cheap red wine all day. By the time the Stones go on stage, and it's a very low-built stage that had been hastily constructed, just a couple feet tall, it's evening, and the crowd is restless and pushing towards the stage. The Hells Angels are in no mood, you know, to deal with these hippies, and they're beating people randomly with leaded pool cues, with full bottles of cans of beer, and one young African-American teenager who's being roughed up by the Hells Angels finally whips out a gun that he's brought with him, and he's immediately jumped by a pack of angels, and they knife him and kick him to death right in front of the Stones as the Stones are helplessly watching this. Now, you know, earlier, as the Stones were performing, Keith Richards, the great lead guitarist for the Stones, or I guess a rhythm guitarist, he, you know, tried to intervene, and Sonny Barger, the head of the Angels, stuck a gun in his ribs and said, "You better keep playing or you're a dead man." So that was the kind of, you know, horrific, turn of events that happened at Altamont. And as I say, soured a lot of people on the dream of the 60s, but, of course, the 60s continued in many ways.
So I want to talk about what the SFPD was like at this point, because they had, and into well into the 70s, they had a lot of really serious crimes to deal with, not the least of which was this figure that was known as the Zodiac Killer.
Yeah, so, you know, after the dream of the 60s implodes in, throughout the country, really, because of the assassinations of the Kennedys and Martin Luther King, because the war is dragging on and on in Vietnam, the cities are exploding, racial, tempests building throughout the country. San Francisco feels that implosion of the dream, I think, more than any other American city, because it was the capital of that dream, out of the counterculture. And so San Francisco is beset in the 1970s with a lot of wreckage, from the sort of after effects of the 60s. There's bizarre crime sprees. In the Zodiac case, of course, is well known, and they made a movie about it. But Zebra, much less so. Zebra was a terrible racial crime spree in a city that prided itself, of course, on its tolerance and its racial civility. But it was a splinter group from the Black Muslims, the Nation of Islam, that went around the city at night randomly picking white targets, young people, old people, men, women, and brutally murdering them. By the end, the official count was 23 people had been murdered. And the city, you know, was on the brink of, you know, a terrible panic. There were white vigilantes threatening, you know, reprisal. In fact, one young black serviceman was shot and murdered one night in San Francisco as apparently a part of this reprisal. And the mayor, in sort of desperation, orders the first case of a city officially ordering a racial profiling. Mm-hmm. Night after night, where young African Americans are stopped on the streets by cops. And so it really brought the idea of San Francisco, I think, as an enlightened city, to a critical point. the city finally gets through it, of course, when the case is cracked, but it really showed the fault lines in the city. It was one thing after the next then, and of course around the same time, the Symbionese Liberation Army bursts on the scene, a strange underground revolutionary group issuing, you know, these extreme demands and kidnapping a newspaper heiress, young Patty Hearst, which of course rivets the attention of the world's media month after month. And then, of course, Jonestown and People's Temple. So, you know, it was one trauma after the next that seemed to befall the city in the 1970s.
Yeah, it's really interesting. This whole book centers on all these questions that San Francisco had to ask of itself and solve for itself. Is it young or old? Is it progressive or is it conservative? Is it black or is it white? And can it be all of those things at the same time and still survive?
Well, exactly. I think, you know, as Stuart Brand, who, of course, the great counterculture figure who started the whole Earth Catalog, and is in some ways kind of a link between the old hippie days, he ran around with Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters, to the digital future, that where San Francisco also played a big role in incubating, of course, Apple and all a lot of the great institutions of the digital age. Steve Jobs, of course, was very inspired by the sort of the 60s counterculture in the 60s. In the 70s. But in any case, you know, Stuart Brand told me, you know, you can't have a Ken Kesey without having a Charlie Manson. When you say everything is possible, which San Francisco basically was in those days, then you get both the dark and the light. And I think that was San Francisco's great contribution, that we pushed the envelope, that we came up with ideas, radical thinking, that really moved the country forward, whether it was medical marijuana, gay marriage, universal health care, green cities. I mean, one thing after the next incubated here in San Francisco, but often in a very tumultuous way. People think that San Francisco just sort of dreamed up these ideas in a kind of peaceful context. But the first culture war really was here in San Francisco before it went nationally, and it was much bloodier here in San Francisco than it ever was at a national level.
What made San Francisco such a particular draw for the LGBT community at a time when it was still relatively unusual for people to be fully out of the closet?
Well, of course, this again goes back to the earliest days. There were drag queen performers and same-sex clubs in San Francisco, even back in the Gold Rush days. I mean, it was a frontier town, a lot of men, not many women. And so there was early on, you know, kind of a drag and gay subculture within the city. And later on, those drag shows become very popular. Finocchio's became a big club that catered to tourists back even in the 1920s and 30s. And then in the North Beach became, long before the Castro, was a real gay underground. That's the Bohemians or Italian section of town. So there was always this aura, and as we talked about earlier, young men coming through town, young servicemen, soldiers being shipped out to the Pacific Theater during World War II, often sort of were able to, for the first time, after coming from small towns all around America, to discover, you know, I'm gay, and actually there's places here in this city where I can find other gay men. And so the World War II, I think, actually had a kind of a catalytic effect also on the gay movement in San Francisco.
The thought of what that must have been like to realize for these young men that they were not the only ones. Surely some of them believed that they were unique.
That's right. And lesbians. It was, you know, both men and women. Mm-hmm. And some, you know, famous clubs here in town catering to lesbians as well, Mona's and others. So, you know, again, the city had kind of a double-edged, you know, relationship with the gay community. There were a lot of police crackdowns. In fact, there were more arrests in San Francisco of gay men in public spaces in the 1960s than there was in New York City.
And despite the Stonewall riots taking place in New York.
That's right. And even before the Stonewall riots, which, you know, are attributed as the beginning of the gay rights movement in this country in 1969, where drag queens fight back against the cops who are harassing them on the streets of New York, there was an earlier event here in San Francisco in 1966 that was very similar, where transvestites were being harassed at their sort of hangout in the Tenderloin, which is one of the rougher neighborhoods. There was a late-night cafeteria called Compton's, where drag queens tended to hang out, and the cops were giving them a hard time one night, and they finally had it, and they exploded, and they started throwing cups and, you know, coffee cups and plates at the cops. It turned into a full-blown riot. They torched a newsstand out in front, and so this is long before Stonewall. San Francisco had its own sort of Stonewall movement.
So let's talk about the People's Temple, which on the face of it, when it was getting started, it seemed like this progressive church that welcomed the poor, it welcomed African Americans, and was led by a man who recognized clearly the importance of having connections in the city's political hierarchy.
Absolutely. Well, Jim Jones, again, is sort of the, I think, leading symbol of the perversion of the ideals of the 60s and how that happened in San Francisco. Of course, he's not a San Franciscan. He comes from the heartland, from Indiana, where he was a pastor of a kind of innovative church that did combine the races. And this is during the 1950s and early 60s, when that was pretty rare. He moves his congregation out to Northern California, to Ukiah, a rural area north of San Francisco, in the 60s. And then decides, because he's very ambitious, that he needs a bigger platform. And in the mid-1970s, he moves the congregation again into San Francisco and into this kind of devastated wasteland of a neighborhood, the black neighborhood, which had been leveled by the redevelopment bulldozers in the Fillmore district. And he realizes there's a vacuum there, and he moves his mixed race, actually heavily African-American, congregation there. And he begins to develop these ties to the local power structure, because he realizes that he is something that the local Democratic Party machine wants, which is, you know, he can deliver campaigners. He turns out busloads of people during election, during races. He buses them from precinct to precinct to deliver votes. And according to many people, you know, getting his followers to vote more than once.
Vote early and vote often, yeah.
Absolutely. So he's the kind of like the army, the political street army, that these politicians like Mayor Moscone and Willie Brown, who was the rising, rising force in state politics, and Dianne Feinstein even, who's, now senator from California, all of them were beholden to in one way or another. You know, and Jim Jones didn't care what party you were in. I mean, before he came to San Francisco, he was in bed with the Republicans in Ukiah, which was a Republican town, and he was writing to Governor Reagan and to Henry Kissinger and others in the Republican Party, offering him, praise and support for them as well. All he cared about was power.
Did Jim Jones win the election for Moscone illegally?
I believe he did. We'll never know, because those records disappeared, the voting records disappeared conveniently, because Jim Jones' right-hand man, his attorney, was inserted into the city's DA's office, and the DA was in charge of looking into the voting fraud. Those records disappeared, and later when state officials and federal officials, after the terrible events of Jonestown, swept into the city to look into it, the records had long since disappeared. But I believe, based on the interviews I did, including with Jim Jones Jr., by the way, who is the black adopted son of Jim Jones, who survived the terrible Holocaust in Guyana, and by his testimony and testimony of others I've interviewed, people were bussed, as I said, from precinct to precinct. They voted multiple times. Mayor Moscone, he was a great, actually, figure in San Francisco in many ways, because he opened up the city to gays and minorities and women, and he sort of broke down this old boys' network of the Irish and the Italian Catholics who'd controlled the city for so long. But he made a deal with the devil, and the devil was Jim Jones. And he only won that race for mayor in 1975 by 4,000 votes, and many people think those votes were delivered by Jim Jones and his organization.
What convinced Congressman Leo Ryan to actually go down to Guyana and investigate for himself these claims of abuse by members of the People's Temple? Because there were those who were sort of, as you mentioned, beholden to Jim Jones, and there were others who were vocal and concerned about what was going on.
Well, Leo Ryan was a maverick, and he had heart, and he's one of the few politicians who comes off in a heroic way during this whole sorry saga. He'd heard from constituents who had family members who had joined the congregation in San Francisco and then been spirited off to the jungles of Guyana by Jim Jones when, the heat finally started to come down on People's Temple. he'd heard from these family members these terrible stories of what was happening within the People's Temple organization, and no one else would look into it because he owned so many politicians, Jones. But Leo Ryan bravely pushed Congress to hold hearings in Washington on People's Temple. He said he would look into it, and he was the only political figure from the Bay Area who had the guts to fly down to Guyana to personally inspect and investigate what was happening. He thought because he was bringing with him camera crews from NBC and a media contingent and others that he would be safe. But there were many people who warned him not to go down there. They knew how unbalanced Jones was at that point, and they thought he would be in danger, and of course he was. And we now know, of course, what happened was that he was killed along with several others by Jones's followers as Jones went completely mad, and he gave his life, which was the only great act of heroism on the part of a politician at that point.
And the city is still absorbing this unbelievable, terrible tragedy when Harvey Milk and George Moscone are gunned down by a fellow city leader.
Well, a week later. So George Moscone by then, and as I say, in many ways, a great, charismatic, charming guy, sort of the Frank Sinatra. You know, he ran around with Billy Brown, his African-American political sidekick, who's like Sammy Davis to his Frank Sinatra. He loved the town. He'd grown up here, Italian Catholic guy, a star at the parochial schools in basketball, and is beloved by the city. And he knew that old San Francisco, so he was the perfect transitional figure to push the city into the future. As I say, you know, hiring gays and minorities, bringing them into City Hall and women. But he was, you know, a good time guy who, you know, also alienated the cops and, as they say, made a deal with the devil, with Jim Jones.
We will come back to this story in just a moment. My guest is Salon founder David Talbot. His new book is called Season of the Witch, Enchantment, Terror, and Deliverance in the City of Love. If you've got a question to ask, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Salon founder David Talbot. His new book is called Season of the Witch, Enchantment, Terror, and Deliverance in the City of Love. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org. So we were about to talk, David, about the assassinations of Harvey Milk and George Moscone. Give us a little background on Dan White.
Well, Dan White was, in some ways, the perfect sort of representative of old San Francisco. He grew up in, you know, Catholic neighborhood, Irish Catholic. His dad was a fireman. You know, he was a very traditional guy. He was a soldier in Vietnam, and he looked around the city and thought it was going to hell. The hippies, the gays, and so he runs for the Board of Supervisors and is elected. In the first election in 1974, that also brings in Harvey Milk, the first openly gay supervisor here in San Francisco. So that election in high relief shows this building sort of culture war within San Francisco.
Hmm. And when Dan White was taken into custody for having killed Milk and Moscone, he admitted that he had done it, but ultimately he was only convicted on manslaughter grounds.
Yeah, and it was an open and shut case, but he'd given this emotional confession to a former buddy of his on the police force, and you know, a lot of people felt that the cops were being too lenient with Dan White, and this confession was, you know, sort of their, they pointed to as Exhibit A. The confession actually, when it's played in court, makes jurors cry. It's a very traditional jury. It's sort of representative of old San Francisco. And he gets off on manslaughter charges instead of murder charges and is sent away just for 4 or 5 years. The city erupts then in rioting. Gays storm City Hall, set fire to police cars, the famous White Night riots or White Riots. And again, looks like the city's on the brink once again of civil war.
Well, I guess we can't have this discussion without talking about the so-called Twinkie defense, which has been sort of misinterpreted and misrepresented over the years. But can you tell us about how that actually played out and how it affected his fate in court?
Well, he had a very clever defense attorney, Doug Schmidt, and among sort of different theories that he pulled out in court was the theory that Dan White was going through a very stressful period and that he was binging on junk food, and so the so-called Twinkie defense was used to explain his state of mind and how the city and sort of the city's liberal political establishment, by refusing to give him back his job as a member of the Board of Supervisors after he'd resigned, you know, had driven him literally off the edge. And so it became known as the Twinkie defense.
Right. So they never did argue that he was hopped up on sugar and therefore committed these crimes.
No, it was just one more sign of how he was, he had cracked under the pressure of working within the sort of snake pit of San Francisco's liberal city politics.
Okay, so David, when Dianne Feinstein takes over as mayor, it's almost inconceivable how much she had on her plate in this city. And this is a place where, things had been tough and in turmoil for at least a decade before then.
Yeah, so Dianne Feinstein, as a very centrist Democrat, in any other city would be seen as very far to the left. But in San Francisco, she was never really that embraced. She seemed too straight-laced. I call her, if you know your old Marx Brothers movies, the Margaret Dumont in a city full of Marx Brothers. Mm-hmm. She's always seemed kind of uptight and befuddled by all the craziness around her, and she'd run for mayor twice and had not been able to be elected. But a very bright woman, very ambitious, and suddenly, as the president of the Board of Supervisors, after Mayor Moscone is assassinated, she's thrust into the office of mayor. And she becomes, I feel, the stabilizing force that the city needs at that point. She continues much of Mayor Moscone's agenda, bringing in gays and minorities into the power structure. But she also draws the line. She won't accept the sort of early gay marriage proposal from the gay community, which is the domestic partners legislation. She says, no, that's too far at this point. So she's kind of this, transitional figure who stabilizes the city. And she, I think, was the great figure the city needed when the AIDS epidemic, which was the final trauma that I deal with in the book, hits the city in the early 1980s. And, of course, there's rising panic at that point. People don't know how the virus is transmitted then. The science is unknown. At the national level, there is panic and a backlash. Figures like Jerry Falwell on the Christian right and Pat Buchanan are using it to as a cudgel against the gay community and calling AIDS God's revenge against homosexuals. President Reagan refuses to even utter the term AIDS in public. But Dianne Feinstein starts to spend more money in the city of San Francisco than the entire national government to deal with AIDS. Other cities and states are dumping their sick AIDS patients in San Francisco, but San Francisco essentially says, under her leadership, we will take care of our own. And that the public hospital here in the city, General Hospital, starts a model clinic, the AIDS Ward 5B, that and these young doctors and nurses themselves didn't know whether they could be infected at that point and take the infection home to their children and their families. So these are heroic people in the early days. But it basically, this they transmit this feeling of compassion throughout the city and a sense that no matter how untouchable or sick you are, we will take care of you, which, of course, is San Francisco living up to its namesake, St. Francis of Assisi, the great Catholic saint, who did just that in his lifetime. And so I think this is the true beginning of San Francisco values.
What's so astonishing about that is that although now it's history and it seems like that's the natural course of things, given the conditions that you just mentioned and the fact that people were afraid and not sure what was going on, it still could have gone either way.
Absolutely. there could have been a rising panic. I mean, people were afraid to go into certain restaurants where gay waiters, they were afraid to go into the Castro district, the gay district, and try and close the closed doors. There was a rising panic and revulsion in the city, just as there was nationally. And it took leadership to calm those fears. You know, Dianne Feinstein, the mayor, was the daughter of a doctor, of a surgeon. She had been married to a surgeon. She knew medical protocol. She went into the AIDS ward. She held the hands of AIDS patients. She showed people that, no, you know, you can be compassionate. You can touch AIDS patients. And you know, and the city should, you know, should calm down. And again, this, you know, feeling came through the gay community, through volunteers who bravely also took care of their own, through the medical community, and the city becomes a model for AIDS care throughout the country. At a time when I said, as I said, that Washington and the federal government was completely ignoring its responsibility, and of course Surgeon General Koop, who was a great figure, later said that he was specifically told, this is President Reagan, Surgeon General, not to deliver speeches on AIDS, not to address AIDS, and he said the feeling within the White House was this, you know, the gay community had it coming. So, look, San Francisco finally, I think, triumphs in this period, and the icing on the cake is the great football team. And I hate to bring this up because the San Francisco 49ers' great dynasty in the 1980s under Bill Walsh and Joe Montana came, unfortunately, at the expense of the Dallas Cowboys in that great playoff game in 1982, in January 1982. But that was,
we're over it now.
Good. I'm glad to hear that.
It takes 30 years, but we're over it.
But that's the famous catch, of course, from Joe Montana to Dwight Clark that sealed the victory that day for the 49ers. You know, that lifted the whole spirit of the city. And a lot of people didn't think San Francisco was a football town.
Mm-hmm.
But when the team won the Super Bowl a couple weeks later and came back, the parade was, I think, a turning point in the city's emotional sort of journey, because hundreds, literally over 100,000 people, more people than had been on the streets of San Francisco since D-Day, cramming, you know, the downtown area, young and old, white and black, Asian, you know, blue collar, white collar, gays and straights, everyone out on the streets for this team that kind of mirrored the eccentricities of the city itself, because Bill Walsh was an odd guy, very brainy coach, more of a poet than a gladiator in some ways. Joe Montana, physically, people didn't think could cut it in the NFL, kind of a spindly-legged sea biscuit of a quarterback. A lot of broken-down veterans and oddballs. But the team pulls together, and by winning the Super Bowl, I think, as I said, is the icing on the cake that allows the city to finally to come together after all this trauma and division and become the city it is today.
I think if anybody in the country is in a position to understand that, the way that a sporting event and a team can bring together people across class and race and culture, it is North Texas. So we can identify with
great
that.
Great football area, yep.
Can you talk about, I mean, how unified would you say the city's culture is today, and what does that mean?
Well, I think those so-called San Francisco values that are reviled, you know, by conservatives and Fox News, have become enshrined here in San Francisco. People just take them for granted at this point. We have kind of a bland mayor these days, a guy named Ed Lee, first Chinese-American elected mayor in San Francisco. And he himself had been kind of a firebrand as a young guy, a young radical housing activist in Chinatown. But he's, you know, pretty centrist guy now, pro-downtown business and all that. And even he, though, you know, just takes these values for granted. In other words, you know, gay marriage, universal health care. We have a citywide health care program here, the sort of green city policies, bicycle-friendly streets. These are all things that no matter who's elected mayor, they have to, they're like mom and apple pie in San Francisco. You have to honor those values. But I think the great problem in San Francisco now is a completely different one, and it's not something I dealt with in the book at all because it really hadn't surfaced at that point. The book ends in 1982, and that's sort of the rising wealth of the dot-com community.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Twitter and Zynga and Facebook all opening big offices here in San Francisco, driving up the prices of real estate and housing. There's a lot of new money in San Francisco, and it's not clear that the diverse San Francisco of the old days that did have a strong blue-collar, you know, population and many different minority groups, that can survive this shock of new wealth.
So in other words, there's no room for, say, a struggling artist or musician or anybody trying to make it in the city. They can't live in the city. They have to be out somewhere else.
That's right. It's getting much tougher for a young, struggling artist to find, you know, their toehold. And so just like in New York, where, you know, artists are forced to move out of Manhattan to Brooklyn and New Jersey, and same here, people moving to the East Bay, to Oakland and other places, which are also becoming quite vibrant. But San Francisco itself is definitely in transition.
Do you think the city has to be careful of allowing that sort of vision of itself to calcify to the extent that it becomes a caricature?
Yeah, there's a sense that it's a museum piece now, that, you know, you go to Grateful Dead night at the ballpark, you know, when the San Francisco Giants are playing and they hand out tie-dye T-shirts, you know, of Jerry Garcia and all that. And so it can become a little kitschy, a little, you know, as I say, sort of like a museum piece. But, you know, those guys, when they first came, and Jerry Garcia among them, were tough guys who really mm-hmm. shook up this town. And it's important to remember that. Jerry Garcia was the son of a woman who ran a bar, a tough bar down the Embarcadero for sailors and longshoremen. His grandmother was a really tough organizer for the Laundry Workers Union. So he was a native son of San Francisco and came out of that older, tougher city. And when the cops started harassing the Grateful Dead over marijuana and all the things they did, the free concerts in the park, Jerry was one of those who was a real hero who stood his ground.
So you live in San Francisco now. I'm curious as to, obviously, there was a lot of sort of academic research and going back through the records. But how much of the flavor of this city at the time before you lived there came from just talking to people?
Well, I always, as a journalist, of course, you know, now I've become, I guess, a popular historian. It's my second book on American history. But I always love, because my roots are as a journalist, talking to people face to face. I don't think it would be hard for me, in a, you know, to do a book where there's no one still around to talk mm-hmm. with, you know, where they've all died off. So, of course, you know, that we're dealing with a period where there's most of those people, thankfully, are still around, from Mayor Feinstein to members of the great band Moby Grape, who I interviewed, or mm-hmm. the Jefferson Airplane, like Paul Kantner. Not all of them, because the 60s was pretty hard. Pretty hard on a lot of people,
yeah.
Or they were hard on the 60s. But I did. I was able to interview over 120 people for the book, and of course, it really, history comes alive when you can talk firsthand to people.
In the last few seconds, because we haven't talked about this, and as a journalist, I'm sure you'd like to, tell us a little bit about Herb Cain.
Herb Cain. Well, he was the great bard. He was the columnist, of course, the daily columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle, and he's never been replaced. He's been, you know, gone now for a number of years, but he really brought the city together. He was the sort of the water hole where everyone convened in the morning, and his column was a mixture of sort of odd little gossip items and kind of heartfelt, you know, sort of messages about the city and what it meant and what it stood for. He was very entertaining, and, you know, he got around everywhere, even into his 70s, near the, you know, the end of his career. You'd see him every night out into town, sort of, you know, picking up tidbits and items of gossip, you know, that he could use in his column. So he was, I think, the great voice of this city, and San Francisco misses that.
David Talbot is the founder of Salon and author of the new book Season of the Witch: Enchantment, Terror, and Deliverance in the City of Love. David, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
My pleasure, Chris. Thank you for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answered the phones. Christine McConnell produced the podcast, and the senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download the free daily podcast online at kera.org/think. Think at kera.org is our email address for comments, questions, or suggestions. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.